Welcome to More Than a Movie, the show about films and filmmaking here on Campus FM. I'm delighted to say we're back today starting our second season of the show with a new extended format. My name's Andrew Bonello, and along with a guest I'll be welcoming very shortly, we'll take a journey into the magical world of movies to explore how and why film is such a powerful reflection of real life's struggles, sorrows, and joys. This week, it's films that shine a spotlight on the self. Yes, we'll be crossing genre boundaries with abandon today, looking at interesting movies from the last few decades which feature introspection and study of the self in one way or another. Coming up later in the show, did you ever fall in love without being quite sure who's falling for who?
I fell for you. It's not something that happens to me.
We'll peek in on a particularly challenging group therapy session.
When did you first realize that something was wrong?
You have no idea what any of us are going through.
And witness an earth-shattering scientific discovery that literally rocked the foundations of the orthodoxy of its time.
Clearly the Almighty can no longer claim to have authored every species in under a week. You've killed God, sir.
Stay tuned for all of that. First off, though, let me begin by introducing our guest this week. Rachel McAuliffe Somerville is reading for a Bachelor of Arts degree in Creative Media Production at MCAST. Rachel's dissertation is focused on psychoanalysis, dreams, and feminist filmmaking. She's made 4 short films already and works as a freelance photographer with a solo exhibition in the works once restrictions are lifted. Rachel loves French New Wave and art house cinema, citing Ingmar Bergman and Andrei Tarkovsky amongst her strongest influences. Upon graduation, Rachel will be moving to Berlin to pursue an MA in directing. And I'm very happy to say she joins me in the studio today. Rachel, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. So, Rachel, let's start with a sort of straightforward question. How did you realize, when did you realize that you had a great love for film and telling stories through the medium of film?
Gosh, I don't think it was a moment, a precise moment as such. I think it just gradually... I remember being 14, 15 and suffering from anxiety and just watching films to get away from that and just go into a new reality. And I remember stumbling upon Twin Peaks by David Lynch, which was a complete brand new surreal world. And I just remember saying, oh, I can do that. I can create something like that, maybe.
Okay, so did you feel maybe in watching David Lynch, for example, that his style of communicating stories matched with your own way of thinking about stories and the world?
Maybe? Yeah, especially what was going on at the time. And then I applied for an advanced diploma in creative media at MCAST.
Okay.
And the course was not very... it was a little bit restricting, obviously, because we barely knew anything about film and it was more corporate stuff, sort of adverts and music videos and whatnot. But then in the BA is where I really sort of was given the creative freedom to do whatever, and that really sort of served as a springboard for me to explore things beyond the course and do a bunch of personal study and just really find my niches. And
yeah, I mean, so that was something I wanted to ask you about, because it's clear from when we prepared that you've done a lot of work and reading beyond the bounds of the syllabus at MCAST. So what direction did that take you in, and what pushed you into that extra study?
I don't know exactly what pushed me. I gradually sort of developed such a passion for it that I just wanted to explore everything.
Okay.
Obviously, it's impossible to explore everything, but I just went into one area, then another one, and another one, watched a bunch of video essays, different films, exposed myself, even my lecturers as well, sort of exposed us to a lot of different things, which was really great, and I'm super grateful for that.
And you've definitely leaned in the direction of psychoanalysis and dreams.
Yeah.
Where has that led you as a filmmaker? Was it particular films you saw that inspired that kind of interpretation of the affective, you know, experience of having a dream, maybe? Or
I think it's a bunch of different things. It's the films I saw, the books I read, the people I met, experiences, a lot of different things. And I just find that such an interesting aspect of human nature to explore.
For sure, for sure. And so, I mean, I've done quite a lot of reading over the years as well. There are, you know, well-known names in the field of the psychoanalytical side of filmmaking. Christian Metz comes to mind his imaginary signifier. So for listeners who may not be aware, he's a very famous piece of work in the field of psychoanalysis and film. But what did you make of Christian Metz, Rachel?
I mean, he's great. He presents a very interesting, well, various interesting theories, but I feel like gorging my eyes out sometimes when I read his stuff.
Yeah, it's not the most easily accessible of prose or of presentation of ideas.
Exactly, really. Yeah, it's quite obscure.
And then, of course, we've got people like Lacan, and I've got a background in the UK. There's Luke Hockley over there, who's quite well known. He's done a lot of analysis of Jungian psychology in film and wrote his book Somatic Cinema, which might be of interest to yourself and the listeners who are interested in that aspect of filmmaking. Of course, Jung was very interested in presenting the archetypes that film tends to fall into, that we've later fallen into with film as a later medium. Let's talk about your short films a little bit, Rachel. Were they productions exclusively done through MCAST and your studies, or were some of them independent also?
The short films, yes, were done exclusively as part of my coursework. But something I'm very grateful for, as in from the course and from my lecturers, is that we weren't necessarily super restricted to the creative brief that we were given. So instead of viewing these as assignments, I view them as opportunities for me to explore and push boundaries and just sort of create with the guidance of a lecturer.
And your supervisors were supportive in
extremely
that?
Extremely supportive, yeah. Very grateful for that.
And what about bringing the teams together? So, of course, a filmmaking crew has several roles that need to be filled. Mm-hmm. Was that other students you were collaborating with, or did you also recruit from beyond the pool of students?
In my first two, which were done in the first year of my degree, I definitely had more sort of student-centered crews. Crews, not really crews, because I don't think that my film crews exceed 8 people maximum.
Sure, but that's 7 people beyond yourself.
Yeah. But then I'd say for the last two, especially like given that they were done further on into the course, I was able to network with more people outside of the course, make new friendships and sort of find new people who were interested in what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. So the last two were actually sort of the crews were all people outside of the course. Some of them were super experienced in film and gave me sort of a helping hand. Other ones were interested in film, but not very sort of, they didn't really know the do's and don'ts and whatnot.
They needed a bit more guidance.
Yeah, and they just tagged along and learned some stuff, and we learned from each other. Initially, I thought that collaboration was a bunch of nonsense, because I thought, you know, I can do this on my own, I can do all this, this is my idea, I can film it, edit it, direct it, get everything and do it on my own. But collaboration is so beautiful, because the ideas that pop up when you're working with people and the input that different people give, and everyone's working towards this goal of completing this film and everyone's sort of in it together, and it's a really beautiful thing. Mm. I've just been lucky to have had amazing people to work with.
That's great. So obviously then you've got a fair-sized team there, and you mentioned that some of the people on your crew were older and more experienced than yourself. How did you find taking the director's role there and essentially orchestrating all those people's contribution? Did that come naturally for you, or were you nervous at first? Or tell us a bit about that sort of learning curve.
Yeah, I would say it did sort of come naturally, because ever since I was young, I'm not bossy. In fact, I always ask sort of throughout the shoot, like, am I being bossy? Am I being annoying? Is it okay? And they're like, yes, chill, kind of, you know, you're the boss here, but you're not being bossy. I'm like, okay, thank you. But I just always make sure that everybody's feeling comfortable, everybody's okay, everybody's hydrated, because that's very important. Everybody sort of is free to say what they want. Everybody can suggest an idea. Mm-hmm. But yeah, again, I've been just super lucky to have had people on my sets who are in it because they're passionate about the idea.
Sure.
So everybody's, again, working towards this goal, and yeah.
And were there aspects on the production set that proved more challenging technically? Did you have more struggles, for example, with lighting or with the sound and effects recording side of things, or how did that sort of flush out on the days?
Yeah, so when it came to, I'm mainly going to talk about my last two because mm-hmm. my first two weren't extremely technical.
That's fine.
With regards to sound, I kind of suck, so so I was really grateful to have had some friends come and help me with sound, so they understood the technicalities and everything, and also lighting-wise. I enjoy lighting scenes, but I find that it's better to have somebody help you and sort of discuss and talk about it with you. Maybe mm-hmm. they can open your mind, you know, and say, oh, maybe it would be better if this was lit in this way, you know.
And have you tended to do a lot of the cinematography on your films, or do you typically have a camera person helming that up for you? Or
I had a camera person for one of my films, and that was mainly because it was a very performance-based film, so I really had to focus on directing my actor.
Got it.
But with my most recent film, I did pretty much all the cinematography, which was really great, as in it was a bit stressful, because
right.
half the time I couldn't, because I'm very small, and the camera was sort of mounted, there was a monitor mounted on the camera, and just kept disconnecting,
right.
so
right.
I was just struggling, and I couldn't see anything for part of the shooting.
Gosh.
But yeah, somehow I managed to film it, and it's just the satisfaction that you get seeing your own sort of stuff there, you know? And it's not just directed, it's filmed as well.
Absolutely, and you've got a lot of plates to keep spinning when you're working on a production like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's change pace a little bit here. So today's topic, Rachel, is films that shine a spotlight on the self. And I think you've got a film, a classic title, that you wanted to talk about a little bit today?
Yeah, there are multiple films that remind me of that, but I would say that one of the main ones is 8 and a Half by Federico Fellini, for sure.
Elegante. Giù definitivamente. Hai ragione.
Thank you.
So, Federico Fellini's celebrated 1963 drama. Now, I've not seen this film, Rachel. Tell me, why should I see it?
Oof.
In a nutshell.
Okay. Oh, gosh, it's a great film. I mean, I remember watching it and just thinking, oh, what is this fever dream?
Mm-hmm.
It's so self-reflexive. It's so ahead of its time. It's, in a way, autobiographical as well. And it's a very personal film, and it almost makes you wonder what's real and what isn't, mm-hmm. within the film, obviously. The use of certain techniques in it is just astounding, and no, it's great. I mean, you won't know what's going on, probably,
right.
even after watching it multiple times, but it's still worth it.
Certainly from the trailer, there's a few shots in there which immediately had me wondering, you know, how on earth did they shoot? How on earth did they film that, you know? Interesting. Okay, thank you for that. So let's have a little musical interlude now. We're just going to play a little bit of the musical soundtrack from 8½, which is composed by Nino Rota. Okay, Rachel, so let's return for a little bit back to discussion of film, psychology and dream in film in particular. So you mentioned David Lynch. Was there a particular Lynch movie that had a lasting impact on you?
I'd say, with regards to his films, I'd say Blue Velvet.
Okay.
But with regards to David Lynch in general, Twin Peaks, for sure.
Right. I mean, all of his films are sort of, as you've mentioned, you know, very strange, you know, trips down a wormhole for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Woody Allen's name also came up, obviously a controversial figure these days for reasons beyond his filmmaking. But what are some of the films that have really struck you in Woody Allen's filmography?
I'd definitely say Annie Hall,
mm-hmm.
and probably also Manhattan.
Okay.
Yeah.
The best known, really. I mean, I've seen some of his lesser known films. He made a film called Interiors. I forget the year. I don't know if you've seen that.
I haven't, no.
It was an uncomfortable watch. I mean, it's a film about a family, a dysfunctional family, which has this very strong matriarchal figure at the center of it all. But it was an uncomfortable. He's got so much insight into the subtleties between relationships.
Why was it uncomfortable?
It was a very tense family dynamic.
Okay.
And the whole film centers around, you know, there's mental health issues involved. It was a couple of years ago.
An interesting one. If you like that, you might like A Woman Under the Influence by John Cassavetes.
Right. Good to know. Thank you for that one. Let's make a note of that, listeners. Okay, also, you mentioned French New Wave and an American art house, avant-garde films. Like, how have those influenced your own work? I mean, is it more on the reading side, or have you seen a lot of films in those sort of sectors? Or?
Yeah, I'd say they haven't influenced, as in they've definitely influenced my films, but I'm yet to make a film with dialogue, and I mean the French New Wave is very sort of, I wouldn't say very centered on dialogue, but for example Jean-Luc Godard often worked without a script and sort of just improvised his characters. He allowed his characters to improvise sort of lines there and then, which is something I'd love to experiment with for sure. So yeah, it's definitely very inspiring in that regard.
Very cool. Okay. So your tastes clearly run more towards sort of the art house and avant-garde side. Mine are a bit more looking at sort of the intersection of that with mainstream and independent genre mm-hmm. cinema. Christopher Nolan, obviously a huge name in cinema globally now, is actually on record in one of his interviews saying that he tries as a arguably a blockbuster director now, to bring some of the avant-garde techniques of past great filmmakers into his work that's obviously seen by a much wider audience. So what I wanted to ask you is, why do you think the audience as a whole for things like avant-garde and independent cinema has remained relatively small over the history of film?
That's a very difficult question. I think part of it is because it's so, well, not all of the time, but a lot of the time it's very raw and it's very real to a certain extent, but it's very raw and very honest. It's a very honest style of filmmaking and storytelling, and I feel that there are certain people who might... I mean, I can take my own, for example, my dad. For example, my dad loves, I mean, he appreciates film, but when it becomes a little bit too much or too honest or too raw and too, he sort of takes a step back, you know, and, and sort of, And I think that's the same for a lot of people. They almost sort of, they're afraid because it's not the comforting, traditional narrative that they're used to with mainstream films.
Right, and perhaps content sometimes also veers
into
more uncomfortable territory.
Yeah, because they push boundaries, you know, and they sort of explore things which aren't usually explored in mainstream film, or they are explored, but not, but to a very comforting sort of inner, sort of, not inner, how can I word it? So they remain within the comfort zone. They do not expand. They do not go out of it. And whereas these filmmakers, and so they just explore these things to a whole different level, a new level, you know?
And to be fair, I think there are niches even in genre cinema, like horror, for example. There are some commentators on the networks like YouTube who uncover some extremely raw work, even in contemporary horror cinema, like building on what the French extreme new wave guys have been doing, even in the last sort of 10 and 20 years. So cinema's such a wide-ranging field, really, with so much material. But it seems we're probably in agreement. Audiences, in a mainstream sense, tend to prefer content that doesn't step too far beyond the bounds.
Yeah, conventional things.
Right, right. Which, you know, I think it would be nice to bring more avant-garde, as Nolan has stated as one of his mission statements, into cinemas, cinema work that's seen by wider audiences. But it's a tricky balancing act, I think, isn't
definitely,
it?
Definitely, definitely. Because at the end of the day, a lot of sort of art house filmmakers put a lot of themselves in their work, and it's almost expository in a way.
Deeply personal works, right, which can leave them very vulnerable, both professionally and personally, I suppose. Yes. Okay, well, so let's talk about your second movie choice today from our films shining a spotlight on the self theme. What's your second chosen movie?
My second is possibly... I'm not going to say my favorite film of all time, because that's bound to change, but it's definitely up there and will remain up there for a very long time. It's Persona by Ingmar Bergman.
Persona is a knowledge, a terrible knowledge of our loneliness, our estrangement, our inability to reach one another. It is a confession of our fears, of man, of failure, of death.
So it's Ingmar Bergman's highly regarded 1966 thriller. Well, Rachel, I haven't seen this film either. Now, I'd like you to tell me, please, why should I and the listeners today watch Persona?
I think it's such an important film. There's so much to say. I need to keep it as concise as I can, right?
I mean, thematically, if you had to choose, like, two themes for the film, what would they probably be? I mean, how closely do they relate to today's topic of shining a spotlight on the self?
So I think it shines a spotlight on two selves. It shines a spotlight on film itself. It makes it very, sort of, Bergman makes it obvious to us, like, he knows he's making a film.
Okay.
The film knows it is a film, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but keep that in mind. Also, It happens to be a story about two women who undergo sort of a, I wouldn't say maybe self-discovery, but also sort of a lot of self-analysis. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, those two things.
Okay. Would it be fair to describe it as a psychological thriller, or is it more of a drama?
I don't...
How would you picture?
Thriller and dramas don't seem... I don't know. I wouldn't say that, no. I don't know what I would say, but not those.
Okay, yes. It doesn't fall naturally into one of those main genres.
It might, but for me it doesn't. I don't know. I think it's... I can classify it under one specific thing.
Fair enough. Well, if that doesn't pique your interest, then I don't think anything will. Thank you for that, Rachel. Okay, so we're going to wrap up here. If people want to find out a bit more about the film work you've done so far today, is there somewhere they can go online on the internet to learn more?
Yes, I have my website. I don't have all my film work up there, but it'll be there soon, hopefully. And it's rachelmsomerville.com.
Okay.
And there's also photography work there as well. I also have a Vimeo, which is, I believe, also Rachel M. Somerville. I'm not sure about, I don't know the Vimeo sort of.
Vimeo.com.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay.
That's great. Okay, Rachel, well, very best of luck to you with your film work. We hope we'll be seeing lots of your work up on the big screen near us very soon. And of course, good luck with Berlin. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now then, what about films shining a spotlight on the self that were shot here in Malta? Well, going all the way back to 1993, we have the TV movie Voyage. An architect and his wife set sail from Monaco to Malta. They pick up another couple for the ride, who turn out to not be quite what they seem.
We'll have a 60-foot catch. We'll sail it to Malta, and then we'll live on it.
For a year.
Wow. But some unexpected guests.
What if we went down the boat with you?
Gil, you just invited yourself on that boat.
I'll pay for everything on the way down. Food, fuel, liquor, the works.
You're on.
So, your journey begins.
We're here to make you miserable.
You like to play with people, don't you?
Are you ugly?
Well, now this film is firmly in thriller territory, so the spotlight on the self can probably be predicted to lie along fairly standard genre lines. Indeed, at first glance, the film bears more than a passing resemblance to 1989's Dead Calm, starring Nicole Kidman and Billy Zane. That said, director John McKenzie lined up a strong cast here for Voyage, including Rutger Hauer, Connie Nielsen and Eric Roberts. Karen Allen also co-stars. Now, if, like me, you were a young man in the 1980s, Karen Allen must surely be one of your heartthrobs. She played Harrison Ford's love interest and the brave heroine in the timeless action-adventure Raiders of the Lost Ark from 1981. She also had a lovely turn in 1988's Scrooged alongside Bill Murray. Yes, that excellent modern retelling of Charles Dickens' classic tale, A Christmas Carol. Back to Voyage, though, the film received a middling critical reception overall, so if you fancy a bit of Malta-based cinematography, some nice yachts, and a bit of modern sea-bound mystery, suspense, and intrigue, you might want to dip your toe in Voyage's water.
I'll shoot you, I swear to God I will!
Skipping right up almost to the present day, and we have Mix Up in the Mediterranean, shot here in Malta at the end of 2020. An amusing tale of crossed identity, a wayward chef pretends to be his own brother in order to compete in a culinary contest, causing a cascade of confusions, both professional and otherwise.
Oh my gosh, what am I gonna do?
Oh, give me your ID.
Excuse me.
I'll go register for you. Julian, it's not going to be the first time that we pretended to be each other. We used to do it all the time.
No. We were kids.
Okay, what if somebody finds out? I just got to go sign a form, right?
I don't really think you've got a choice. Give him the ID. Give him the ID.
Are you... Oh, fine. You be friendly, okay, and you smile.
And try to say French words every once in a while.
Yeah, I don't know French. Oui, bonjour, merci. Stick to the basics. Okay, okay, geez. I can be you for like 5 minutes.
Well, the setup might not feel that original. It certainly seems to nod at various classics long gone, including, of course, Shakespeare's very own Comedy of Errors. But this Hallmark movie is actually a rather charming little piece, and does rather make Malta look like the French Riviera, I must admit. Never a bad thing, n'est-ce pas? Jessica Lowndes is very convincing in the female lead, and Jeremy Jordan takes on dual roles here, portraying both brothers in various scenes, and those often scenes in which both brothers appear simultaneously, courtesy, of course, of a little Hollywood magic and a good body double. It's far from an easy task, and I thought Jordan pulled it off rather well, no doubt under solid helmsmanship from director Jonathan Wright. The film also features a number of roles that were filled by local actors based here in Malta, and for the most part, they acquitted themselves rather well on screen. I should also add the disclaimer that I myself was an extra in one of the scenes in this film, but you'll really have to squint pretty hard to spot me here. Damn it. Now, if you've ever watched the Hallmark Channel, you'll be familiar with their formula. They tend to tell very conventional and sweet romantic stories with impeccably good-looking actors in the lead roles. Well, that might not be to everyone's taste, but you have to give them credit for the pipeline that the company has built. They're churning out full-length TV feature films like Mix Up in the Mediterranean several times a year, with many of them, like this one, being shot on location. It's an impressive machine that they've built. Cinephiles might even sneer at such pedestrian commercial fare, but filmmaking at this level costs big money, and when it comes to the numbers, I'm fairly sure that Hallmark is doing just fine, thank you very much. Indeed, it was nice to have them choose Malta for one of their stories, so check out Mix Up in the Mediterranean if you can.
Running the culinary contest, it's the Olympics for rising chefs.
Too bad I got all the culinary talent in the family.
I can cook circles around you.
I will compete as you.
What? That's crazy.
I'm Julian's husband.
Yeah.
Yes, wait, no. Yes, I am you. You are me.
Dude.
Okay, please stop.
She finds out we were in big trouble.
It's like you're two different people.
Well, now let's sail beyond Malta's rocky, once sea urchin encrusted shores to discover some films which truly shine a spotlight on the self. Our first movie today is from back in 1999, The Sixth Sense, which tells the tale of a disheartened child psychologist who tries to help a very troubled young boy.
You know the accident up there?
Yeah.
Someone got hurt.
They did?
A lady.
She broke her neck. Oh my God, but you can see her?
Yes.
Where is she?
Standing next to my window.
Well, M. Night Shyamalan's celebrated supernatural thriller is, by now, famous as a landmark genre movie. And the director has come under a lot of flack for later movies he's helmed. The Sixth Sense, though, is undoubtedly his finest hour. The film is absolutely dripping in mood and mystery, and the deeply melancholy themes and performances are underscored by a superbly haunting musical soundtrack composed by James Newton Howard. Let's have a listen. The film is quite brilliantly cast, paced, and staged. Child actor Haley Joel Osment was a revelation at the time, earning an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor.
She wanted me to tell you.
Oh, please.
She wanted me to tell you she saw you dance. She said, when you were little, you and her had a fight. right before your dance recital. You thought she didn't come to see you dance. She did. She hid in the back so you wouldn't see. She said you were like an angel.
And it's a real shame you can't see the imagery from that last clip. Toni Collette, who was also Oscar-nominated, does tremendously heartfelt work here as the embattled single mother of the troubled boy. And Bruce Willis gives arguably the performance of his career here as dysthymic child psychologist Dr. Malcolm Crowe.
And his wife doesn't like the person that he's become. They barely speak anymore. They're like strangers. And then one day Malcolm meets this wonderful little boy. Really cool little boy. Reminds him a lot of the other one. And Malcolm decides to try and help this new boy. Because he feels that if he could help this new boy, be like helping that other one too.
Where's the story end?
Now, although The Sixth Sense received 6 Oscar nominations in total that year, it didn't actually win any. And that could be quite telling, really. The Academy of Motion Pictures, in this period of the late 1990s, did have something of a track record suggesting that it was rather hesitant back then, and for a long time prior, to give major awards to genre movies. It does seem, though, that in recent years that attitude towards genre films is finally thawing a little over in Beverly Hills. Here's another of the film's main musical themes, which plays under a scene when the little boy runs across town to seek refuge in a peaceful local church, trailed by the curious doctor. I saw this film in the cinema back in England with 2 of my closest friends, back when it came out in the late 1990s, and I must confess, I was totally blindsided by it, and spent the entire closing credits of the film sobbing like a little baby, I kid you not. In the pub afterwards, my buddies seemed genuinely concerned for my emotional well-being. They'd simply never seen an outburst like this from me. Now, granted, I probably had other things going on in my life back then that maybe needed an outlet, so maybe this film was the trigger I needed in that moment. But boy, what a trigger.
I don't see anything. Are you sure they're there?
Sometimes you feel it inside. You're falling down real fast. You ever feel the prickly things on the back of your neck?
Yes.
That's them. They get mad. It gets cold.
How often do you see them?
All the time. They're everywhere. Help!
Whilst ostensibly a supernatural thriller, The Sixth Sense is, in essence, very much a study of self, with both child and doctor going through troubling self-examination and revelation in a deeply touching rapport that they develop over the course of the story. And I'm giving nothing away here for those of you who still haven't seen this film. Are there any of you still out there? If so, what a treat you are in for.
I think that they know that you're one of these very rare people who can see them. So you need to help them.
What if they don't want to help?
I don't think that's the way it works.
How do you know for sure?
At times genuinely creepy and unsettling, do please be prepared for a few unnerving moments. But overall, let's recognize this film for what it is, a masterpiece that introduced a whole new generation of film viewers to meaningful genre pieces. It's surely a crowning moment for Shyamalan and all cast and crew involved. In structural terms, this is about as well-crafted a mystery as you're likely to encounter. So let's pay homage to some beautiful cinematic work here, with some last heartbreakingly dulcet tones from The Sixth Sense. Phew! Well, and so at that, it's on to our second film shining a spotlight on the self. From 2008, it's Passengers, in which a grief counsellor, working with a group of plane crash survivors, finds herself at the root of a mystery when her clients begin to disappear.
They came down on the beach. Just a handful are left. You should handle the whole group.
There were 10 survivors of Flight 117.
When did you first realize that something was wrong?
You have no idea what any of us are going through.
Some returned in shock.
Hey! Wait! Don't go!
But one...
How are you feeling?
I feel great.
...came back with a gift...
A relatively unknown and certainly underrated film, in my view. Passengers is a rather unusual romantic thriller hybrid, arguably crossing both of those with a mystery. It's headed up by Colombian director Rodrigo Garcia, and initially builds its story around a group undergoing post-traumatic therapy, headed up by Anne Hathaway, in what's certainly one of her lesser-known roles. Genre actors Patrick Wilson and David Morse give solid support here in a deceptively simple piece of storytelling.
Your patients are highly susceptible to external influence right now. It's my dog. He's buried in my mom's backyard. He died when I was 6.
How do you know where I live?
He knows personal things about me.
You have a sister.
What?
You should call her.
It's always nice to come across a film which takes the time to observe characters struggling to come to terms with a difficult life event. Here we get a real sense of the loss these people have suffered, and their therapist's very sincere efforts to help them. But mystery soon overtakes proceedings, and our well-meaning protagonist in Hathaway finds herself way out of her depth. Now, mood is so important in a film like this, and the soundtrack's musical theme does a fine job helping the director simultaneously generate a sense of unease, crossed with one of wonder and hope. All this, despite the relatively mundane urban setting of much of the story. Composed by Edward Shearmore, let's have a little listen.
Thank you.
another film about which the less you know, the better, I urge you not to confuse this film with the 2016 sci-fi romance of the same name, starring Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt. That's also a decent film, albeit a rather different cinematic beast. Nay, Garcia's 2008 genre piece here is very much a study of self, identity, and one's ultimate place in the world. Even if the superbly exposited ending left me feeling really quite deflated, this is a delightful little story, and I urge you to take a butcher's hook, also known, of course, as a blimmin' good look.
Doctor, your credibility is on shaky ground.
That crash, it's like being born again.
Behind the mystery...
Stay away from me, Claire. Stay away.
...lies a secret.
One by one, they're all disappearing.
Not of this world.
Our third film today moves us up to 2009, and it's called Creation, which tells the story of English naturalist Charles Darwin as he struggles to complete his seminal work on the origin of species, whilst maintaining his relationship with his wife.
I implore you, please do not push him.
No one can push Charles.
I'm a scientist. I dare not study for the fear of seeing more clearly what is already as plain as day.
What do you say scared of?
It's only a theory.
It changes everything. Suppose the whole world stopped believing that God had any sort of plan for us. Apart from anything else, it would break your mother's heart.
Of course, our story centres around Charles Darwin, surely one of the most important scientific figures in human history. The narrative manages to extol the evolution, pun intended, of this truly great mind within the very urbane setting of his home and family life. Let's have a listen to an excerpt from Christopher Young's musical soundtrack to get just a smidge of an idea of the epic scale at which this beautiful human drama unfolds. Now, fans of Australian directors will be familiar with Peter Weir's 2003 seafaring adventure Master and Commander, Far Side of the World, starring Russell Crowe. Well, in that film, Paul Bettany played the ship's surgeon, who takes important scientific samples when the ship takes a break from military conquest to moor in the Galapagos Islands. This obviously paralleling the famous real-life Voyage of the Beagle, penned by Darwin and based on his discoveries on that famous journey in the 1830s. Well, John Colley, who wrote the Master and Commander screenplay, obviously got a taste for penning Darwin's story for the big screen. For our film here today, Creation, Colley adapted the book Annie's Box by Randall Keynes into a screenplay. The movie was headed up by veteran British director John Emile, who brought Paul Bettany aboard once again to take on the role of Charles Darwin here.
Clearly the Almighty can no longer claim to have authored every species in under a week. You've killed God, sir.
Do you not care that you and I may be separated for all eternity?
Well, of course I care. Of course I do.
Strike hard with a blow that is utterly conclusive.
A little local aside, keen film writers in Malta might remember that back in 2019, John Colley himself actually came to visit us here in Malta, and he gave a 3-day course on screenwriting at the Spazio Creative Cinema in Valletta. I attended and had the privilege of meeting John, a gentle and amicable man of great talent, who shared lots of wonderful stories and insights into the screenwriting process with his class here in Malta that week. Back to the film he wrote here, then, Bettany is joined by Oscar winner Jennifer Connelly taking on the role of his wife, as well as Benedict Cumberbatch and Toby Jones in supporting roles. The acting throughout here is really strong. It's Bettany's best role to date for me. The film is peppered with interjects and vignettes, highlighting the experimental and scientific process that Darwin pioneered in order to formulate his seminal theory of genetic mutation and crossbreeding. All that against the backdrop of a disturbing psychological deterioration with a very poignant genesis.
You say you take no comfort from religion, but do you have faith?
You do have enemies. But you have friends, too.
I owe it to my children to have the courage of my own convictions. My title will be On the Origin of Species. I shall keep God out of it.
The real power of the film, though, is in its subtext and the multiple levels at which the story functions. On the surface, a historical family drama, the story is very much about a man's struggle with himself, his work, his place as a family man, and indeed his scientific role, given the deeply contentious implications of his discovery for the prevailing religious society of that time.
I'm finished.
Supposing I think it should be destroyed.
Read it first.
There is grandeur in this view of life. From so simple a beginning, endless forms, most wonderful, have been and are being evolved.
It's rare to watch a film which gives you the sense that it's leading you in a certain direction, but still feels satisfying when you finally get there. There's a superb genre spin to the whole story as penned by Colley, but I won't spoil it. Suffice it to say, the film builds to a devastating emotional climax. You'll know it when you get there. Absolutely heart-rending stuff. And this will be a real treat for those of you who will choose to watch the film after hearing about it today. And I sincerely hope that you do. Let's enjoy a little more of the music. Whilst the story culminates in Darwin's completion of his seminal work and how that balances with his fragmenting family life, the film, once again, is really about a much deeper and sadder story. The closing shot of the movie is, to date, one of the most beautiful cinematic conclusions I've witnessed. A single, poignant, peaceful image, at once summarising a life both wonderful and tragic. If you've any interest at all in biopics focusing on scientific figures in history, you absolutely must check out the triumph of genre storytelling that is Creation. Finally for today, then, we jump right up to 2019 for Every Time I Die. When Sam begins to suffer memory lapses and time discontinuities, it represents the start of a perilous journey of self-discovery for both him and his friends.
Why are you here?
I fell for you. It's not something that happens to me. When did I say that?
Sam! Everything okay?
What are we doing out here?
What are you doing out here?
Talk about a film shining a lens on the self. This entire story is a deep dive down the rabbit hole of identity crisis. Director Robbie Michael helms a modest production using an outback location, but gets tremendous performances out of his relatively unknown ensemble cast, all of whom are asked to do quite a bit, both dramatically and physically. I confound you to guess where this story is going on a first viewing. Part relationship drama, part psychological slash supernatural fragmentation, part even a war veteran's struggle with PTSD. All of this is combined with an overarching therapeutic journey. The narrative is constantly interjecting changes of perspective, flashbacks, and disjoints, particularly as the climax approaches. So grab on tight, folks.
I've been having these blackouts.
in those moments, hours sometimes.
I found myself in places and I don't even know how I got there. It's like I'm possessed or something.
There's lots of disorientating in-camera effects and irises used here, and for the most part they work well. First-person sequences too are used to constantly uproot our position of comfort as viewer. Symbology is rife in the visual composition of the piece. The mirror and one's reflection therein is repeatedly used as a device to make us question who we are. Photographs too are frequently employed both as metaphor and as an echo of past moments in the story. Michael and co-author Gal Katzir certainly know their film genres, patching into all sorts of classic tropes, yet still managing to stitch them together in intriguing and, frankly, really quite disturbing ways. All these visuals and plot devices convey a disruption in psyche and memory due to a tragedy endured as a child. This is a theme which the film keeps returning to and ultimately is centered around. Indeed, there's a rich tradition in thriller and horror movies of a wounded protagonist seeking to right a past wrong at any cost.
Who are you? Please. Please, come on. This has happened before.
What happened before?
Your condition. You thinking you're someone else.
Is this merely a classic case of the unreliable narrator at work? Whatever, the protagonist's tale is a sorry one indeed. Come to think of it, who the protagonist even is in this story gets less and less clear with time. Yet, believe it or not, that's actually a good thing here in cinematic terms. I kid you not.
You are the same person I've loved for 10 years.
Pull over!
Think it's okay to sleep with another man's wife?
You don't have to do this.
I saw you kissing. How stupid you think I am?
As the climax approaches, you'll probably feel as lost as I did. Intrigued? Well, you definitely should be. Take a stiff drink and make sure you're in a comfy chair so you won't sprain any muscles when you jump out of it. Then take a fragmented, blurry, perspective-shifting journey with Every Time I Die.
Get out!
I know who I am. This has happened before.
Well, what did you think of the movie selection in our show today? For that and any other feedback, suggestions and questions, please email us at morethanamovieqs@gmail.com. That's morethanamovieqs, all one word, @gmail.com. This More Than a Movie episode was written and presented by me, Andrew Bonello. A big thank you to our guest, Rachel McAuliffe-Somerville, for joining us, and also, of course, to our sound engineer today, Redent Abdillah. The intro music was Creepy Comedy, and the outro is Inspiring Teaser, both by Raphael Crux at filmmusic.io. And those clips are licensed under creativecommons.org, version 4. Thanks for listening, and I do hope you'll join us again next week on More Than a Movie.